Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. More than 1,000 people came to Cal Anderson Park last night on Capitol Hill in Seattle for a candlelight vigil to remember victims of the mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. A gunman killed at least 49 people and wounded another 53, which makes it the worst shooting ever in this country. KUOW's Jim Gates went to last night's vigil.
People started gathering hours before the vigil began. Parents brought their kids and couples spread out blankets on the lawn, taking in the scene. A local art store donated poster boards and paints so that the people could make signs, signs declaring love and support for the LGBT community. Zuleha Azundart is Muslim and a single mother of two. She said she was afraid at first, but decided to come to the vigil because she felt a kinship with the gay community.
I feel like the struggles that they've been through and are still going through very much resonates with me and the struggles that I go through on a daily basis, being a visible Muslim woman of color. And it's not just because of that those similarities that I'm here, it's because it's the right thing to do to be here, and everyone should be here.
Cecilia Hayes lives in the Central District. She brought her 7-year-old daughter, Julia, to the vigil for a teaching moment.
My daughter and I were having a conversation this morning, and she was asking some tough questions. So we ended up having a conversation about how some people do bad things because there's something wrong with their brain, and some people do bad things because there's something wrong with their heart. And either way, we wanted to be with other people who stand up against folks who do bad things.
As more and more people gathered, Seattle police walked through the crowd. A bomb-sniffing dog nosed around picnic baskets. Bethany Simpson carried a bouquet of flowers, handing out roses.
The yellow ones symbolize grief and connection. The red ones symbolize respect and courage. And then the purple symbolize love and friendship. And we just wanted to, you know, reach out a hand to anybody here who is feeling the need to share their grief.
Her friend came to the vigil to show people that the gay community is not afraid.
We've been dealing with this not just for a couple days. This is gay history back to the very beginning. We've been shot at and beaten. You know, people have tried to take our places away from us, and they're never going to, you know.
Standing up to fear was one of the main themes in a somber speech given by Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. By the time he took the stage a little after 8, more than 1,000 people had gathered at the south end of Cal Anderson Park.
We will, as we have in the past, face this fear. We will not be intimidated. We will stand together, and we will be strong.
Governor Jay Inslee also addressed the crowd, along with other prominent members from Seattle's LGBT community. Then, a moment of silence. As people held candles high into the night sky, someone began counting, soft at first, and then louder.
10, 11.
They were counting the number of victims from the Orlando, Florida shooting. As the count grew higher, so did the emotions.
45.
People wept and held each other tight.
47.
After the count ended, people hugged. Then the crowd slowly dispersed.
50.
There was nothing more to say. For Sandy Turner, it was an emotional evening.
My heart's heavy. My heart's very heavy. That count was really powerful. Powerful. And I'm very proud to be a Seattleite, and I think that we rally so well, and in times like this, just means a lot. Also means a lot to have our straight allies.
Oh, well.
Seattle's pretty special in that regard.
At Cal Anderson Park, I'm Jim Gates, KUOW News.
You heard a little bit of Seattle Mayor Ed Murray there last night at Cal Anderson Park. This morning, Murray told KUOW's Emily Fox that the magnitude of the Florida shooting is shocking.
It's hard to know what went through my mind. It's hard to get your head around it. As a mayor, obviously, you immediately think about what do we need to do here? Is there anything more that we should be doing to prevent a possible terrorist attack in this city?
Beyond your role as Seattle mayor, how did this tragedy affect you on a personal level?
Well, you know, I guess as a young gay man growing up, coming out, and seeing so many of my peers die at such a young age, I was struck because I had hoped that this new generation that can get married, that has rights, wouldn't have to live through such tragedy. And instead, I am just stunned by the fact that we are now the victims of the largest attack on our community in its history.
Yeah. What's your message to members of our LGBTQ community that are shaken up by yesterday's killing in Orlando?
Well, you know, I'm shaken up too. I mean, yesterday I was more stunned in a state of shock as we worked very hard to provide an opportunity for people to mourn. Today I am just sick to my stomach as the magnitude of this hits me, as I'm sure people throughout the city. I think, though, we have a choice of reacting one of two ways, because it's going to get worse as we hear about these young people's stories, mostly young people. It's going to become more painful, and we're going to get more angry. So our choice is we can stay in that anger, or we can try and work through it and find a way to be hopeful, to be creative in how we move forward in this tragedy, so that someday going out to a bar is not an act of courage. We have one of two choices of which way any of us can react, and it is not going to be easy as we start to learn more about those who died and those who tried to help them.
I saw the numbers of people that gathered last night. There were hundreds and hundreds of people. What do those numbers say about the people who are living here in Seattle?
There were literally thousands, because they poured out of the park onto the street. What it says, again, about Seattle is our ability, and you know, this, we have our own very difficult conversations as a city, but our ability to come together, in a public place as a large crowd, after someone tried to prevent other gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender people from gathering, our ability to stand up for fear, against fear, that's what it said to me. Our ability to come together, our ability not to be intimidated.
Well, the Seattle Pride Parade happens in less than 2 weeks. We'll see a lot of people gathered there. What's going to be done to make sure people are safe?
Well, as with mayors across the city, we are stepping up our security enforcement around gay and lesbian establishments. We did a similar thing, particularly around African-American churches after the shooting in Charleston and the murders there. We will have additional security at the Pride Parade this year, given the circumstances. We will open up the Emergency Operations Center to coordinate that event, as we did during the Seahawks parade. But we can do those things, but it's going to be very important for people to come out, not to be intimidated, and secondly, to, if they see something, to let the police know. If they're concerned about something, to let the police know.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray there reacting to the biggest mass shooting in American history over the weekend. The FBI says the gunman, Omar Mateen, told a 911 operator that night, Saturday night, early Sunday morning, that he was loyal to the head of the Islamic State group. Mateen's father's calling his son's massacre the act of a terrorist. Mateen was killed in that incident. Here locally, a mosque operated by the Muslim Association of Puget Sound says it was told by Redmond police that there was a credible threat to the mosque, and we are investigating that. We'll bring you more on that this afternoon on KUOW. And finally, here are a couple of ways you might help. Florida's biggest LGBTQ advocacy group is taking donations. That group is called Equality Florida. And Bloodworks Northwest in Seattle has donated blood to Orlando, and now they're asking you to come in and help replenish local blood supplies. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Among the federal benefits that veterans receive, they're entitled to a free burial at a veteran cemetery, except that in a lot of cities, those cemeteries are just about full up. So the Veterans Administration is offering families another option, cremation. From Los Angeles, John Ismay reports.
Sean Harvell was such an exemplary airman that the Air Force used him in recruiting commercials. As an Air Force combat controller, he earned 2 Silver Stars, several Bronze Stars, and a Purple Heart in Afghanistan. His uncle, Bill Maher, says Harvell was pretty much great at everything he did.
He was a very bright person, a very accomplished person. He was a very good athlete, very strong.
So when Harvell drowned last month off Alamitos Beach, his death hit his family hard, especially since Sean died just 4 years after his younger brother, Andy, who was also a combat controller, was killed in Afghanistan.
I think they were as close as twins is the best way to say it, because they, one without the other, it was always Sean and Andy, and that's how we talked about all of them all the time, it seemed. They were a pair.
They were a pair, and that's how they're buried, one on top of the other in Section 89A at the L.A. National Cemetery. The Harvell family, especially the boy's mother, wanted them laid to rest there.
It was very important for my sister, especially, so that when she visits the site, that she can be close to both. They're right there for her, so it means quite a bit because she does visit very often.
It's also a rare honor to be buried at L.A. National these days. While military veterans have the right to a grave in a national cemetery, the one here in L.A. has basically run out of space. After 9/11, the cemetery cleared out a new area to serve those Americans killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's why Andy Harvell rests there. Pretty much everyone else buried at L.A. National in recent years is the spouse of a veteran already interred there. Andy's wife gave up the opportunity to be buried with her husband so that Sean could be there instead. The reality is, in the city with the most veterans in the country, vets generally don't have the option for a casket burial in Los Angeles.
There's a large population of veterans, and we haven't been able to really serve them for many years.
Mary Elizabeth Jones is an administrator at LA National. She says when families call to inquire about a grave here, they're mostly sent to Riverside National, about 80 miles away. But the VA is working on a fix.
We're looking at the future site of the Los Angeles National Cemetery Columbarium.
A columbarium, a memorial wall where cremated remains are placed in secure niches, often many rows high. That's the new trend at veteran cemeteries across the country in places where new land is hard to come by. The VA hopes to have one built in LA by 2020. Columbarium-only veteran cemeteries are planned in Indianapolis, Jamaica, New York, Chicago, and Alameda. This spot just west of the 405 freeway is 15 acres of cast-off equipment and weeds right now. But Tom Ruck, the cemetery's new director, says by the time they're finished, it'll be up to par.
You have, you know, concrete barriers over there. You have piping here. I'm sure you have some type of wood and concrete waste there. You have a parking lot over there that, you know, and all this will be redone and become beautiful, just like the National Cemetery across the street.
Paul Lally served in the Air Force from 1952 to 1956. He lives on the VA campus in Westwood, not far from where the columbarium will be built. He says he wants to be cremated and interred there when his time comes.
And I chose this place because, A, it's across the street, and, B, because my family lives down here. So if they wanted to come by once a year and say, hiya, Dad, how you doing? You know.
But Lally says it's about more than just convenience.
Well, it's an honor, really. Because like them, those who have passed on, you know, we, for one reason or another, we decided to serve our country. We've done it. We've done it honorably, and therefore we have a right to be buried there with some dignity, and that's the place to do it.
The demand for the new columbarium is already incredibly high. By the time it opens in 2020, officials estimate the backlog will be so great that they'll be doing 15 interments a day for 6 months to catch up. I'm John Ismay reporting.
That story was produced by the American Homefront Project, which is a collaboration of KUOW, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, Southern California Public Radio, and WUSF Tampa. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Wildfires have already started burning here and there around our state. Not knowing whether this season's fires are going to be as bad as last year, the state is training new firefighters. One of those trainees, Ben Hale, has worked for the Department of Natural Resources for a couple of years, but he's never been on the front line fighting fires. He told me why he is changing that.
The stories that I heard from my coworkers were just really inspiring and sounds like it was an extreme challenge. And it was all hands on deck last year because it was just a record year that only beat out the previous year's record year. So it's been a lot of work with the Department of Natural Resources the past couple of years to fight these fires. And I just felt like I wanted to be a part of that too. There's a lot of strong camaraderie and excitement going on with the work that they do. I wanted to have that, you know, sense of teamwork and accomplishment at the end of the day. And I also, being a firefighter, you get to protect the natural resources and people's property. So it's a worthwhile endeavor, and it's something that I'm really passionate about that I want to pursue and be a part of.
Ben, when most of us hear about wildfires and firefighters, it's not good. I'm sure we hear just the very worst end of it, and there's more to it, but I still have to wonder what makes you go towards something that is that dangerous.
Well, I just see it as an essential function of the Department of Natural Resources and something that we can't not do. And taking a look at the coworkers that came back last year, they were dispatched over and over and over again, and they were very, very tired, and it's just I could see that I could help out by contributing as well. So many hands make light work, and I like the idea of being a part of that team.
Was there any hard part for you about making that decision?
The hardest part for me was the fact that I have a young child at home, and my wife is a professional career woman. And it's a lot to ask of those who I would leave behind. I could be gone up to 16 days at a time. So I needed my wife to be on board before I committed to being available. And after long conversations and strong conversations, we decided that this is the best route for us, not only for the professional experience that I would get, but for the satisfaction I would get as well being a part of the program.
You called it a strong conversation with your wife. May I ask what was said?
Well, it was a combination of the dangers involved, as well as the hardship that she would have, not knowing what my day is going to be like and how it was been when I would be out there, and the hardship that she would have of being basically a single mom, which is a challenging experience in and of itself. So there was a long discussions and a lot of planning ahead of time to make sure that we have the infrastructure in place so that she's not overwhelmed, but also that she knows what's happening with me when I'm out there.
How did you win her over?
Just with lots of hugs and kisses and making sure that she feels safe and on board. I'm not going to put myself in danger on purpose at all. And even if I sense that something dangerous would be happening, the training involved with a firefighter program has equipped me with the ability to be safe and know the situational awareness to make sure that I know where to go and what to do.
So does that caution you have and your training mean that fear is not a part of this decision for you to fight wildfires on the front lines?
No, I'm not afraid. I'm nervous, obviously, and anxious. I'm very excited about the program, and I'm very excited to get the experience. I'm very excited to feel that sense of camaraderie I mentioned. Nervous because this is a new experience for me. I'm a recreation manager for the Department of Natural Resources. I talk to the public a lot. I do capital planning projects for recreation facilities out in the forest. So fighting fires is not in my exact wheelhouse, but there is a need for more firefighters. There's a need for intelligent, hardworking folks, and I like to put myself in that category. So it's something that I think I can contribute well to.
What do you think you'll be thinking about when you get your very first call to go fight a wildfire?
My first thoughts are going to be towards my family. My next thoughts are, okay, here's the job to do. How do I go out and do it? We are out there because we choose to be, and we are out there to make sure that state of Washington's natural resources, as well as the people, are safe and secure, and that's always the number one priority.
Ben Hale is a new wildfire fighter for Washington State. This season will be his first year fighting wildfires on the front lines. Our governor says he's bracing for this to be a bad wildfire season.
Our forests are in very poor health. The beetle kill has been astronomical because the climate has changed. And as the climate changes, these beetles can overwinter instead of dying in the winter. So we have massive numbers of dead trees. That's a concern. But we do know one thing. All of us can help reduce the threat of this fire.
And how can you do that? Well, Governor Inslee says you can keep dead vegetation, pine needles and stuff, away from buildings. You can trim the brush. Last year, as we've said, was the worst wildfire season in Washington State history. Hoping it's not the same this time around. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The big business news of the day is that Microsoft is buying LinkedIn for $26 billion. That is the biggest deal Microsoft has ever done, Todd Bishop of the tech news website GeekWire.
That's right. It's not the biggest deal Microsoft has ever attempted. It was more than $40 billion that they tried to buy Yahoo for, but it would be the biggest deal that they've ever completed.
Right. Okay, so this is not quite Yahoo, but more than Nokia.
Right.
It's big. And I have to tell you, Todd, my reaction, you know, most of my interaction with LinkedIn involves deleting emails from LinkedIn. So help me understand why Microsoft is finding it worth $26 billion.
LinkedIn is to business what Facebook is to the rest of our lives. For many people in the corporate world especially, they offer a lot of tools to do things that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Find job candidates, find jobs, communicate with people behind the scenes, even if you don't know their email. And Microsoft sees in that an ability to incorporate and essentially integrate Office, which is the productivity cloud, essentially, the productivity tool, with the productivity network and the professional network. So in many ways, it's a complementary business to Microsoft.
Okay, I want to try to figure out how that generates gobs of money. But I have this quote from Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella.
Now, you have the ability, whenever you're looking up a contact, not only to see that contact with the information that's contained in Active Directory, but you can get at the full richness of their information in the professional network. And who are all the others in their professional network?
Full richness. Can you give me an example of how somebody might use this new integrated Microsoft LinkedIn company?
One of the examples that Microsoft gave today involved Cortana, Microsoft's personal assistant, which is its speech-enabled alternative to Siri and Amazon's Alexa. Cortana would be able to look at your calendar, your Outlook calendar, see someone that you're meeting with later in the day, and say, hey, did you know that you went to the same college as Bill or whoever it might be? Mm-hmm. You might want to bring that up. So you can see where the access to the LinkedIn data is going to inform the users of Microsoft products in ways that really wouldn't have been possible if the companies were separate.
Okay, and how is that lucrative for Microsoft?
Here's the thing. On a standalone basis, LinkedIn is actually not profitable. They posted a $166 million loss last year on $2.9 billion in revenue. So this is really more of a bet that Microsoft, by doing these things, will get more users over time because the products are that much better. Now, Office is wildly profitable. So that's the idea. Make Office better, sell more Office, and then, you know, basically ride off into the sunset.
Got it. Okay. Satya Nadella said one more thing that I wanted to run by you because it made me think about our future. Okay. He says that he asked himself what is most needed in today's world.
For sure, I'm a deep believer in productivity tools and communication tools. But think about taking that and connecting it with the professional network.
So does that mean that our future involves more uncertain employment, or I should say change, you know, we'll be constantly redesigning our careers?
If you think about the way that corporate networks work right now, you're getting a lot of information about stuff inside your company. But as we transition, to your point, to something more along the lines of a gig economy where you're working for a variety of different employers, that's going to have to span different companies. So under this scenario with Microsoft owning LinkedIn, you might be able to see a feed of information that includes stuff from your LinkedIn network, different files that your coworkers are sharing with you. It basically brings it all together, at least under the vision that they presented this morning.
Let's talk about Nokia for a moment, because we talk about what a huge bust was when Microsoft bought Nokia cell phones. And this is more than triple the price tag of that gigantic deal. What are the odds this turns out to be a bust or a hit? What do you think?
I think they have a better shot with this than they did with Nokia. That said, it's by no means guaranteed. The reason that they have a better shot is that they are learning the lessons and letting LinkedIn maintain its identity, its standalone operation. They're not going to be moving folks wholesale up to Redmond from Mountain View. They're going to let them have their place there. The CEO, Jeff Weiner, is going to report to Satya Nadella, not to someone else inside Microsoft. So that has been the formula that Facebook, for example, has used with its acquisitions, WhatsApp and Instagram and all those others. That has proven to be successful in the tech industry. So Microsoft has a better shot there. That said, you're right. I mean, Microsoft does not have a track record of many successful acquisitions. Its track record is, you know, most beneficially described as checkered.
Checkered, yeah. Okay, a couple more things then. You said that people are not coming up to Redmond. This doesn't look like it's meaning more jobs in the Northwest?
Not in the short term. LinkedIn has about 9,700 employees around the world. That compares to more than 100,000 employees for Microsoft and about 40,000 here in the Puget Sound region. It does not look like there's going to be a lot of change short run. That said, if this translates into more office usage and a bigger footprint for office long term, it could have a significant impact long term on jobs up here.
Okay, the bum Nokia deal, that was hung on the last guy.
Yeah, Ballmer.
That was Ballmer. This is Nadella's first big acquisition as the head of Microsoft. Does it tell us anything about him or the next big acquisition?
It really does. If you look at what Steve Ballmer was trying to do with Nokia, he was trying to make Microsoft like Apple. In other words, Microsoft similar to Apple in that it was going to be the company that made everything from the operating system to the apps to the hardware.
The hardware.
Exactly. What you're seeing Satya Nadella do over the past year through this and all the other moves, including backing away from Nokia, is saying, no, that's not what Microsoft is. Microsoft is a productivity company where they define productivity very broadly in terms of actually doing things that have an impact on your life and the world. And so that's what you're seeing here. It's not trying to be a fully integrated, you know, OS to device technology company.
And you sound basically positive about this LinkedIn deal, basically positive that productivity company, that's the way to go?
I think it's a fascinating move. Microsoft under Satya Nadella has certainly become a much more interesting company to cover. Mm. And it's in part because he's making some moves that are logical in a lot of ways. And this is just the latest.
Maybe logical, but the history has been checkered. That analysis of today's big news, Microsoft's a $26 billion purchase of LinkedIn, from Todd Bishop from the tech news website GeekWire. Always good to talk with you, Todd.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. What can we do about Western Washington's heroin crisis? Heroin-related deaths are at a 20-year high in King County. Heroin addiction is driving more people onto the streets. One idea is to make it easier for people to manage their addiction with medication. There are two drugs, methadone and buprenorphine, that can be used to treat opiate addiction. However, some people don't want to see those treatments in their neighborhoods. Did you see that episode of Frontline not long ago? It showed how community opposition in Bremerton led to Bremerton stopping a plan for a methadone clinic there. Puyallup has a temporary ban. Well, I talked with University of Washington professor Caleb Banta Green. He's on a King County Heroin Task Force, and he told me how those treatments work and why he thinks they are the right way to go.
People don't get addicted to treatment. People are addicted, and the treatment medications manage that addiction. And so the issue is that anybody who takes opiates, you take opiates for a month, I take opiates for a month, we'll get physically dependent. We stop using them, we'll go into withdrawal, we'll feel bad. That's a normal reaction. That's physical dependence. That happens to everybody. What happens to some people is they get addicted. Addicted is also psychological and social. I'm thinking about them all the time. It's getting in the way of my relationships. The issue is when you have these medications on those opiate receptors, the person can feel normal, they're physically stable, and then you can deal with the psychological and the social stuff. And when that stuff starts going away, your use isn't out of control, it's not getting in the way of your life, you are now having your treatment managed. You are in recovery on these medications. You are still physically dependent. You still have opiates on those receptors to feel normal and not go into withdrawal, but you're no longer addicted.
If you can be physically dependent on your medication, you know, you get this sort of backlash of you're trading one drug or one addiction for another. Mm-hmm. What do you say?
So what I say is it is this what sounds subtle but is profound distinction between physical dependence and addiction. It's needing to understand the difference between those two things, and that a person who is opiate addicted is out of control. It is impairing their ability to function in their life. It is a very different thing to say that a person is on a medication to feel normal, whether we're talking about antidepressants or whether we're talking about hypertension medications or whether we're talking about Nicorette. These are all harm reduction medications that are essentially getting a person to a stable state so that they can function.
So some people don't like the idea of methadone. What are the options?
So there are a range of other options. The main other treatment medication option that also has very good outcomes in terms of improving functioning and decreasing death is a medication called buprenorphine. The most common brand name is Suboxone. And that medication can also be given out in opiate treatment programs side by side with methadone. Some people feel better on one medication or another, but very different than methadone. It has a lower level of control by DEA. It can also be prescribed by a doctor in her office. And that person can then pick up a prescription at a pharmacy. So that really normalizes this as a medical condition that a doctor can manage in their office. As a quick aside, methadone can be prescribed by not just doctors, but nurse practitioners for pain out of their offices. But if it's for addiction treatment, it has to be in a very structured, tightly regulated drug treatment clinic.
Many 12-step programs will tell you the key is abstinence. Don't take it. How effective is abstinence for opiates?
It's not very effective in terms of outcomes for most people. Some people can do well in 12-step, right? 12-step works really well for the people it works for, but it is not a universal treatment for most people. And in fact, a huge study in the United Kingdom last year followed 150,000 people over time and found that your chance of dying was cut in half when you're on buprenorphine or methadone compared to not being in treatment or compared to being in counseling supportive things only.
Okay, so some people think using opiates to treat a heroin addiction is swapping one addiction for another. We've talked about that.
Yep.
How have you seen that stigma affect whether we build new clinics and where we put them?
You know, some communities ask for these clinics to come into their communities, and then once it gets politicized, all of a sudden moratoria go up, and they're banned from siting new clinics in these locations. And my understanding often that is coming from the business community or from city council members and from political pressure to not welcome these clinics into their communities. And the issue with these clinics is that basically if you have opiate-addicted people in your community – they're likely to be using opiates for many, many years, and they're either going to be getting prescription medication somehow, or they're going to be injecting heroin. Either situation is a chaotic lifestyle that involves a lot of illegal behaviors that has a big negative impact on the community, or they could actually be getting managed on medications in that community and get stabilized and be able to function and not have a negative impact on the community.
So what is your vision for, in the future, this is the way we treat opiate addiction in Puget Sound area?
There's methadone clinics, which I think there will be an important role for quite a while for. But in order to undermine the heroin market, methadone clinics are a tough way to do that. The real way to do it is to make buprenorphine available at every single pharmacy and that there's a linked data system so that you could show up at any pharmacy and they could see, does this person have a prescription for buprenorphine? When did they last get their dose? What's their insurance? And so that, you know, if I'm in a U district today, I can pick it up at Bartels. And if I'm in Wallingford tomorrow, I can pick it up at the 45th Street Clinic or the Walgreens over there. That anywhere you go, that it's easier to get treatment medications than it is to get heroin. Until we get to that point, I don't think we're going to see a meaningful change and really a substantial change in opiate addiction and mortality.
And how heavy a lift is it to get to that vision, that system that you want? Because you go around, you testified to Congress. How far are we?
You know, in King County, we need minimum 5,000 more treatment slots, probably 10,000. And in Washington State, we probably need at least 20,000. This is not a small incremental thing that we need to do. We need to scale up and give people a range of options that actually fit the way they need to live their lives as best we can. And that's going to be methadone in some circumstances, and it's going to be buprenorphine in other circumstances, as well as other supportive things like counseling and 12-step and so on. We need to dramatically increase capacity to improve the quality of lives for individuals and communities. I think the odds are low, but I think that's what we should be aiming for. Otherwise, we're just not going to get there. We have 600 people a year dying from opioid overdoses in Washington State. You know, there's no reason that number should be anywhere near that. But if we're going to make a meaningful dent, the best long-term overdose prevention is getting people stabilized on treatment medications like buprenorphine or methadone.
Caleb Banta-Green is a member of the King County Heroin and Prescription Opiate Task Force, and he wants to see more people treated with medications like methadone and buprenorphine. We also have news about another drug, the synthetic drug Spice. Have you heard of Spice? There's a proposal to fight the use of that drug in a new way. Most drugs get outlawed because of their specific chemical compound, and that compound is banned. But the city of San Diego is working with scientists now to find out what the drug does in the brain so that they could outlaw any substance with that effect. It's a different way to look at it, and we're going to have that discussion today on KOW's All Things Considered. Also, we are gathering information about that mass shooting over the weekend in the Orlando, Florida nightclub. The head of the FBI, James Comey, says the shooting is a federal terrorism investigation.
The reason for that is there are strong indications of radicalization by this killer and of potential inspiration by foreign terrorist organizations.
Comey says the shooter told a 911 operator he pledged allegiance to the Islamic State group. However, it's not really clear which terror groups he supported.
But he also appeared to claim solidarity with the perpetrators of the Boston Marathon bombing and solidarity with a Florida man who died as a suicide bomber in Syria for Al-Nusra Front, a group in conflict with the so-called Islamic State.
That shooter died in the incident Saturday night, Sunday morning. Gun control came up today in Washington, D.C. The shooter had an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle and a handgun with him. California Senator Dianne Feinstein says Democrats want to expand the list of people who cannot buy guns.
Those categories include felons, fugitives, domestic abusers, among some others, but they do not include known or suspected terrorists. And the bill we're talking about today simply would close that loophole.
So we're going to catch you up on the details, the investigation, the conversation that people are having now politically. We'll talk about Trump and Clinton, all that during KOW's All Things Considered today. Hope you can join us. Writer Peggy Orenstein has a 12-year-old daughter. And she started hearing stories from other parents, stories about sexting, about binge drinking, about how their kids would hook up to have sex and then not talk to each other again. The end result of those stories is her new book called Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Peggy Orenstein told KOW's Jeannie Yandel she almost decided she didn't want to hear those stories at all. And then she realized she had to hear them and she needed to hear them firsthand.
Parenting from ignorance and fear is always a good strategy, so I decided that probably wasn't the best idea. And meanwhile, all that was going on, and we were having this umbrella conversation in the culture about assault on campus, which, you know, has burst forward again with the Stanford case, and consent, and that was so important. And yet I also felt that it really should be the beginning of a conversation rather than the end point, you know, consent, and that I really wanted to know what was happening for girls after yes, and, you know, what we needed to do as a culture to make that experience the best it could be for them.
Well, you talked with 70 girls from middle school age to college age. How did you get them to talk to you about this? I'm trying to imagine what those conversations were like. How did you even get them to open up?
It was so not hard. It was so not hard. You know, I shouldn't say that. The first couple of interviews I did were awful because they would talk to me and I was kind of shocked by what they were saying, and I betrayed that in my face. And those were the only two girls that I spoke with who would never respond to me again when I would, you know, text them or email them or try all the 5,000 different ways we get in touch now. But with most of the girls, with many of them, I am regularly in touch. And the fact was, what they would say to me is, nobody's ever asked me these questions. Nobody's ever talked to me about this. I've never had the opportunity to reflect on my personal life. And they would write to me later and say, you know, because of our conversation, I've changed my major. Because of our conversation, I've really thought about this relationship I'm in. Because of our conversation, I've really thought about what hookups mean to me. I mean, the conversations ended up being transformative for them, as well as for me. And they were really, really, I mean, even if I had never written the book, they were some of the most meaningful conversations I've had with people.
Why?
Well, just because the girls were so willing to be honest, were so willing to go deep, were so willing to reflect on who they were. And it became so apparent to me as I spoke to them that we have kind of placed planet sex in this other solar system from everything else that we talk about with young women. So, you know, the young women that I spoke with, as you said, they were actually more like 15 to 20, so more like high school and college. And they were such bright girls. They were all college-bound or in college, and I chose that demographic because I really wanted to talk to the girls that we think of as having the most opportunity and being, you know, the primary beneficiaries of the feminist movement. And yet there was this disconnect between all of that. They were leaning in everywhere in their educational lives and their professional goals and all of that, but toppling in their personal lives. And one of the girls said to me, I come from generations of strong women. My grandma was a firecracker, and my mom is a professional, and she's so smart, and my sister and I are really loud, and that's our form of feminine power. But then she detailed her sex life to me, and it was kind of a series. She was 20 and an Ivy League college student, and she said, you know, it was a series of one-off kind of hookups that weren't very satisfying or reciprocal or enjoyable. And she said, I guess, you know, we girls are just socialized to be deferential and not express our wants and needs. And I said, but what happened to that strong woman? She said, well, nobody ever told me that strong woman image applied to sex. So there was this real disconnect among the girls that was really poignant to hear.
You said the first couple of girls you talked to, what you heard was kind of shocking and you betrayed that in your face. Why was it shocking?
You know, what surprised me was what I did know I would be talking about were, you know, ideas about the media and about the selling of hot to girls and the impact of self-objectification. What surprised me was the lack of pleasure and the lack of reciprocity and their acceptance of that. And, I mean, I came to a number of conclusions about why they felt that way. One was about their... Girls felt shame around their own genitals. They would talk about them at once as, you know, like being a combination of sacred and icky. And I really came to believe that part of that was that we had performed what I called the psychological clitoridectomy on American girls. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when we have our children, when we have our infants, we tend to name all the parts on a baby boy's body. At least we'll say, there's your pee-pee, you know, something. Mm-hmm. But with girls, we go right from navel to knees. And that leaves that whole, you know, situation in there unspeakable. And then they get to puberty education class, and they learn that boys have erections and ejaculations, and girls have periods and unwanted pregnancy. And you only see that internal diagram that looks kind of like a steer's head, you know, the one I mean, right? and
yes.
Then it kind of grays, right? Then it grays out between the legs. So we never say labia. We never say clitoris. And no surprise, fewer than half of teenage girls have ever masturbated. And then they go into their partnered interactions. And we somehow expect that they're going to have a voice, that they're going to have some sense of equality, that they can, you know, we have set them up. They can't articulate their needs and wants because they have no idea what those might be. And we have to ask, who is entitled to engage in an experience? And the girls did feel entitled to engage. But then you get to the other questions. Who's entitled to enjoy the experience? Who's the primary beneficiary of the experience? And how each partner defines good enough? Mm. And I honestly think those are hard questions for us as adult women, and if we ask them, there's a lot of reckoning to be done. But when we're talking about girls, I just kept coming back to this idea that those early foundational experiences should not be something they have to get over.
What does consent even look like? How did these girls talk about their understanding of consent and what that means in a situation where they feel like they can engage, but enjoyment is something they don't really feel like they're entitled to?
I mean, that was one thing that I felt, as I said, I was looking at what happens after yes, and that, it was really clear to me, played into what's happening on campuses. Because even if you think about, like, I was in a classroom towards the end that was a co-educational classroom where kids were really trying to work these ideas out together. And one of the boys raised his hand and he said, you know that baseball metaphor? You know the one that we all learn, right? I mean, every American knows that baseball metaphor for sex. You know, rounding the bases towards home, right? And he said, in baseball, there's winners and there's losers. So who's the loser supposed to be in sex? And really, in that metaphor, I think girls are the field. They're not even the opposing team. They're the field on which the game is played. And the way that we teach kids about sex, it embeds coercion into the process. And girls' limits are seen as a challenge. And when we're talking about heterosexual sex, girls' limits are seen as a challenge for boys to overcome. And that promotes this idea. I mean, I heard a lot of girls did tell me about assault. And honestly, it wasn't something that was that much on my radar when I started the work. This conversation hadn't really burst onto the scene yet. I wasn't surprised by it, but, you know, obviously it was really hard to hear. But what was equally hard, and sometimes even more hard to hear, were these garden variety stories from nearly all the girls that involved being pushed past their limits, that involved coercion, that involved alcohol, that involved all of these things that reduced their ability or confounded their ability to be able to say what they wanted, know what they wanted, feel what they wanted. Are you there?
Yeah, no, I'm here. It's I'm quiet because that's a very difficult thing to hear.
It is really hard. And I would go back. I mean, I haven't talked about this a lot because I've really resisted having interviews be overtaken by discussions of assault because that wasn't really what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about this other piece. And I do feel really strongly that by helping girls and boys understand the role of and the existence of female pleasure in the sexual equation, we will level I hate to say the playing field because I'm staying in that metaphor, but we will shift that conversation a little bit. I do really think that's part of it. But I would go back to, I mean, I did the work all over the country, so I was often staying in hotels, and I would go back to my hotel room and, you know, just leave the lights on and lay on the bed and, you know, just sort of have to sit there with what I'd heard and what I was bearing witness to and let it, you know, kind of absorb, because a lot of times the interviews were really, really tough, even as they were gratifying and important. They were hard.
What do you do with that information? I mean, with that body of information that girls have these kind of, as you said, garden variety stories about being assaulted, about being harassed, what's the way forward? How do you fix a problem like this?
You know, we have had just abysmal sex education in our country for decades now, and this is one of the results of that, frankly. And when we look at comparisons with other countries, I mean, even in that Stanford case, I don't think it was an accident that the two people who stepped in, chased the rapist down and tackled him and held him until the cops came, were Swedish. They were not Americans. It was two Swedish graduate students. And one of them was so distraught by what had happened that he was sobbing too hard to talk to the police initially. And one of the things that I did was compare Holland to the U.S. because we have data on how Dutch college women talk about their early sexual experience versus American college women. And in every outcome, whether you're talking about fewer negative outcomes like disease, pregnancy, regret, drunkenness, or more positive outcomes like knowing your partner very well, being able to say what you want and don't want, preparing responsibly, having a good time, having a positive body image, all of those things, the Dutch girls come out ahead. And what they said was that from a very young age, parents, teachers, and doctors all talked to Dutch kids really clearly and openly about their expectations and the realities and explicitly around sexuality. And one of the really big differences that struck me as a parent was that while American parents are not necessarily less comfortable talking to their kids about sex, we generally only emphasize risk and danger. And Dutch parents talk about balancing responsibility and joy. And that is such a paradigm shift, because I know that had I not done this work, I would have talked to my daughter about contraception. I would have talked to her about disease protection. And because I'm very modern, I would have talked to her about consent. And I would have thought that I'd done my job. I would have thought I'd done a great job. And now I know that's really only half the conversation.
Peggy Orenstein wrote the book Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Reacting to today's weekend attacks at the Orlando, Florida nightclub, Donald Trump put some of the blame on President Obama.
We're led by a man that either is not tough, not smart, or he's got something else in mind. And the something else in mind, you know, people can't believe it. People cannot they cannot believe that President Obama is acting the way he acts and can't even mention the words radical Islamic terrorism. There's something going on. It's inconceivable. Right. There's something going on.
Hillary Clinton has often avoided using the phrase radical Islam. Today she told CNN, quote, "We can call it radical jihadism. We can call it radical Islamism. It matters what we do more than what we say." And Clinton said, "We also want to reach out to the vast majority of American Muslims to help defeat this threat." We'll be following this story as the day continues on the BBC, on All Things Considered today on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information.